George Johnson, are you there?
Hey, John, how are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you doing out there in New Mexico? Still as hot as it was?
It's great. It was great to see you and Valerie a couple weeks ago when you were out here. So things are pretty much the same. It's really cooled off since you were here. We finally got the beginning of the real rainy season. So you'll be getting just into the high 70s and 80s during the day.
Yeah, I gotta say, it was brutal when we were there. I think it was in the mid-90s, virtually every single day we were there.
Yeah, mid-90s, but with fairly low humidity.
Yeah. But anyway, we had a great
So
time.
wasn't as bad as New York.
Yeah, it's actually really nice here today. It cooled off a little bit, but you know something I just read? I heard on CNN yesterday that Moscow just had temperatures over 100 degrees for the first time in history.
Wow.
So these anecdotal pieces of evidence for global warming, which I think are more persuasive than the really hardcore scientific stuff, are just becoming overwhelming.
Yeah, more persuasive to the public, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, because unfortunately, of course, you can find just as many anecdotal examples of, we just went through the coldest December we've been through in decades, and then that, people kind of pick their anecdotal evidence
Yeah,
instead of
that's true. What the hell
looking
are you
at the
gonna
bigger
do?
picture.
People are just
Yeah,
stubborn and
we could
ignorant.
talk about that later because I heard a really good lecture on global climate change
I
in
think I
Santa
know what
Fe.
you're gonna talk about. So before we get to New Mexico though,
Yeah, you had something you just written you wanted to talk about.
So I just posted something on my blog at Scientific American Crosscheck this week about General James Mattis, who was just appointed by Barack Obama to become the commander-in-chief of both the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's replacing General Petraeus, who's taking over in Afghanistan from Stanley
Right.
McChrystal, the guy who got in trouble because he was blabbing, he and his aides were blabbing to a Rolling Stone reporter.
Right,
And
right.
just through sheer coincidence, I happened to be at a conference on military history at Ohio State in May, and Mattis was one of the speakers. He was kind of the guest of
Oh.
honor, and he spoke for about an hour, totally off the cuff. And after his appointment he was a four-star general. I knew he was a very important person, but I didn't realize in what high esteem he was held by lots of people until Barack Obama made him the commander in chief. So I transcribed the talk that he gave at this conference and posted some excerpts on my blog for Scientific American. I'll just mention a couple of the things that he said. Probably the most newsworthy, I'd say, was that he said that he said this about the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Sincere, intellectually vigorous, honest, patriotic Americans say that was the dumbest thing we ever did, to go to Iraq, and I will not disagree one bit. But then he goes on to say that, of course, he does whatever his commander in chief tells him to do, and he also says that he thinks we're achieving victory in Iraq, and he says that we have to achieve victory in Iraq and Afghanistan, or our security will be endangered because our enemies will be emboldened and so forth. Just one other thing, and I'll drop this, and people can go check out other things he said on my site. And the other thing that he said that I thought was surprising, I'd never heard before, was that when the Russians invaded Georgia in 2008, they initially sent a group of men called the Vostok Battalion over. And these are guys who are basically thugs in the employ of the Russian army, and they went in to deliberately rape and pillage. Those are the words that Mattis actually used. Georgian civilians, and they're creating all this this trouble and chaos. So then the regular Russian troops can come and rescue the Georgians from these bad guys who actually also are under Russian command.
Yeah.
It strikes me as very controversial. It strikes me that Mattis is basically accusing Russia of war crimes.
Yeah.
I'd never heard this, so I thought I should post that.
Yeah, so you mentioned that in your column. And
yes.
Yeah, so, yeah, well,
So anyway, that's that.
I'll have to read that. I haven't read it yet, so I can't really, don't know what to discuss, but I will check it out.
Yeah, as I said, I just wanted to mention it. I'll post a link on the Blogging Heads site so people can go look at that. Because I don't very often come across what I consider to be actual news, so.
Yeah, no, that seems very newsworthy, and so you're continuing with your interest in war.
Yeah, until I drop dead, I guess.
Yeah.
So anyway, New Mexico.
So what did you think?
We had the best time. I mean, there's so many different things to do and see in New Mexico. There's so many different cultures that converge there. I was constantly reminded of your wonderful book, Fire in the Mind, where you described all these different religious and scientific cultures in New Mexico, Indian and Spanish, and the scientific communities at the Santa Fe Institute and Los Alamos and places like that. And I'd never experienced that so dramatically as I did on this trip.
It's all these different ways of like carving up the world into a system. I found it. I mean, growing up here, it was always kind of in the back of my mind. And then, so this book had been, really brewing in my consciousness for years. And then one day on a drive from Los Alamos Laboratories on the top of the Pajarito Plateau down to San Ildefonso Pueblo, this old Tewa Indian village on the Rio Grande, just that stark juxtaposition of world views really got my mind spinning and ended up in this book, which is now a pretty old book. Mm-hmm. But it's still there. I still get emails about it.
I'm sure you do. And
often from people who came to New Mexico and experienced some of the weirdness that I'm hoping you're about to describe.
Well, actually, before we talked about some of the really odd things that I encountered in New Mexico. Actually, I'm getting a weird echo on this line. Are you?
No. Uh-uh.
Okay,
Yeah, I think it's probably just,
I'm hoping it'll go away.
Yeah, because, they're not really recording what we're hearing the phone. But So it's probably okay, but, if you want, we could.
Well, maybe Blogging Heads could just splice out that little section. I'm not hearing it right now, but I was getting my own words were coming back to me with like a 2-second lag.
Oh, yeah, that's really annoying. Yeah. That makes it hard to talk.
All right, so actually, I thought maybe we could start by having you describe this because I'm really curious about it. This sustainability conference I guess you attended at the Santa Fe Institute, or sponsored by them,
it was great. It was called Sustainability Summer School 2010, and it was the second one they've had, I believe. It is the Santa Fe Institute, and they also do a complexity summer school, and there's another one on aspects of economics that my friend John Miller, an economist at Carnegie Mellon University, runs or co-runs or something, This was really interesting, and Doan Farmer,
yes,
of chaos fame, and character in Glick's book Chaos, James Glick's book Chaos, and he's one of the scientists at the Santa Fe Institute, so he's one of the people who spearheaded these sustainability summer schools. Mm-hmm. So I was invited to sit in, and it was 2 weeks, mostly up at St. John's College, which is just up the hill from my house, and every day we went and had these lectures and discussions, and it was interesting. It started off with you know who Dennis Meadows is?
Well, something. I just did a Google search this morning. I was trying to find some information on this conference on the web, and I came on a Santa Fe New Mexican, your local newspaper, story about
right, they wrote a story about it. They mentioned that local journalist and gadfly George Johnson is at the... Yeah, I was actually supposed to give my comment to the reporter on what I thought of it, and then I didn't get her email in time, so... So that was kind of funny, because I was probably the least qualified person at this conference. There were like a couple of dozen of these just the most impressive, brilliant, committed, idealistic young people from all over the world attending this conference. And in many ways, that was the most impressive thing. And I'll talk a little bit about that later on. But just to start with, it began with this guy, Dennis Meadows, who's famous for the book Limits to Growth and the Club of Rome, what was often labeled as kind of a neo-Malthusian, assault on industry. And I guess over the years has come to be viewed in a more moderate and sometimes even positive light. Mm-hmm. I mean, not sometimes positive. Of course, it depends on who's viewing it.
Right.
But do you remember that? Like, God, that was back when we were in college. Limits to Growth came out.
Well, when you were in college, I think I was living as a hippie down in the Florida Keys in 1972 when that came out.
Okay. But it made quite a splash. And I guess there was a big press conference at the Smithsonian. And at least the way it was depicted at the time, it was this radical kind of doom saying, we're going to run out of resources. The population's growing exponentially. But we're based on resources that are either not growing at all or just growing linearly or, in any case, less quickly than the population, food, energy, water. That basically, the world was doomed. I mean, that was certainly the message that I got at the time. And I think that's really is how it was promoted. But now I was reading about like the Wikipedia articles and things, and it seems to be viewed very differently. And I wonder how much, revisionism is going on or how much people, realize that, that the report was not making radical predictions so much as just giving you various scenarios to think about. And
well, you know,
that's something I still don't know.
One of the reasons why the Club of Rome and its predictions about all the horrible things that were going to happen in the future, running out of resources and so forth, were discredited in a lot of people's minds, was that there was this famous bet between Julian Simon, who's a conservative, pro-growth, I guess you'd say, libertarian economist, and Paul Ehrlich, who's a biologist.
Population bomb,
yeah.
Right?
And I think Ehrlich.
Yeah, that book came out at approximately the same time.
But I think Ehrlich was also one of the members of the Club of Rome. I might be wrong, but he certainly agreed with its basic message. And as you say, he wrote The Population Bomb, which is very popular. He was going on Johnny Carson, and he had a very prominent platform for his views, which were, as you say, very Malthusian. And Ehrlich and Simon had this bet about what would happen to prices of crucial resources, particularly metals, as I recall. And Simon said that they would become much more expensive over time. Ehrlich said they would become much more expensive. And Simon said that as a result of improvements in technology, the price would drop dramatically. Simon turned out to be absolutely right. And that's something that Ehrlich and some of the other Club of Romers have had a hard time overcoming, sort of as a public relations problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, yeah, and that was a common criticism that they didn't really take pricing mechanism into account. And the fact, if oil becomes more expensive, it'll make sense to invest more money in drilling to reach, more expensive oil. And you can do things like put platforms off the Gulf Coast. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, that's one thing the bet doesn't capture is that, at what price to the environment, decrease in prices of raw materials sustained.
Right.
So, pricing mechanisms assumed that, guaranteed that the price would be steady or even go down as, increasing demand caused, more exploration, more exploitation of the minerals. But, of course, there's this huge environmental cost that doesn't often get factored into the equations. And
that's true.
And that was one of Meadows' big things. And it was interesting the way he started this out was he had everyone sit down at, several different tables and divide into teams and play the simulation game called Stratagem.
Yeah. I see.
So this is based on, there was something called World 3, which was the simulation that Meadows and these other people at MIT originally did to get the Club of Rome predictions, mm-hmm. The limits to growth. And it's really a board game. And, you know, each one of you is, the head of a different country or a banana republic or something. And each round, I mean, you start with a certain amount of resources and capital, and you have to decide how much capital are you going to use to develop your energy infrastructure, how much for food, how much for social services for the population. And then there are these built-in assumptions, like if you raise the standard of living of your population growth will go down because it tends to happen that in countries with higher standards of living. Mm-hmm. And all these little feedback loops. So each round, you basically decide what you want to do, like how much money you want to borrow. And that was kind of, I was sort of pushing for just borrowing up to our teeth and getting so horribly in debt that, that we could obviously never pay it back. And then our creditors would be beholden to us, which seems to often happen.
You would have thrived on Wall Street with that kind of reasoning, I think.
But actually, from what I could tell, and I didn't get into a lot of detail because it's a very complicated game with a very steep learning curve, but, you don't actually interact with the other countries,
uh-huh.
So like everything outside of your own domain is kind of an abstraction, I believe. So, but anyway, after each round, you make these decisions and then you fill out these little pieces of paper and, very primitive and very low tech, which, Meadows considered part of the appeal, so you didn't get dazzled by the computer graphics.
Mm-hmm.
But so then we'd give our little pieces of paper to Dennis, and we'd go to lunch, and then he would, type the numbers into his laptop and then crunch them with some program, that had embedded within it all these assumptions and feedback loops and cross dependencies. And then you come back and find out what shape your country was in. And,
mm-hmm.
and we didn't have enough time to really do enough rounds so that you could really tell much, but apparently, it gave you the flavor of it. And he goes around the world and I think more in the past than now and, meets with groups of, leaders at a, in different countries' economic planners and has them play the game just to kind of, bring home all the little assumptions and contingencies and, depreciation of capital and what effects that has. And,
well, did he?
It's really very interesting.
Well, when I'm looking at this this article on the Santa Fe New Mexican, and what he seems to be saying. Well, first of all, he says that basically we're stuck with global warming. That even if we
he's very very pessimistic.
Yeah, even if we eliminate all carbon
right.
emissions today, the world will keep getting warmer because of all the CO2 that's already in the atmosphere.
Right.
And so
right.
we're going to have shorter winters, higher temperatures. You're going to have a lot of triple digit days in Moscow. All the glaciers are going to melt. Blah blah.
Yeah.
blah. What he seemed to be saying as the solution to that, and this really reminded me of the small is beautiful ethos of the 60s and 70s. Was that we should
Schumacher.
Everything should be local. So our energy should be obtained locally. Our water should be obtained locally. Food, building supplies, all that sort of thing. So it reminded me of that kind of hippie ethos of living off the land, and it just seems I don't know,
He definitely doesn't come off as a hippie.
Yeah. Okay.
But definitely as a pessimist. And there was this real interesting kind of semi-debate between him and Doan Farmer. And Doan's much more optimistic,
mm-hmm.
and especially about the ability of technology to help overcome some of these problems and inequities. But at the same time, he's not any, gung-ho. Technology will fix everything. And
you mentioned before that this guy is emphasizing the costs, the hidden costs of, or not so hidden costs of extracting energy, and so that would be pollution. It would be things like we're experiencing in the Gulf of New Mexico right now. When you push the technology too far, you get these accidents.
Right.
Yet on the other hand, last week I went swimming in the Hudson River, which would have been unthinkable. It would have been dangerous 20 or 30 years ago because the river was so heavily polluted.
Yeah,
air in New York City, as in pretty much every single major city in the United States, is cleaner now than it was 30 years ago because of automotive technologies, even though the populations are much greater. So,
You think of London in the 19th century.
Right.
So, that's it's interesting. There's really kind of two main schools of thought, the pessimists and the optimists. And the optimists, at the extreme view, they say, wow, the more people there are, the more ideas, there will be, because there's more brains working together to solve our problems, which has kind of been the Catholic Church's, argument against any kind of population control. But, that seems like, I don't know. I've never really been able to buy into that. To me, the big problem is exponentially increasing population.
Well,
especially in undeveloped countries where, there's fewer resources to sustain it. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, during the 2 weeks, population control was rarely mentioned during this conference. And I think we've talked about that before, how I've really been struck by how that's almost been just shoved off the table in any of these discussions of, the future of the world economy and the climate, and how, when we were going to college in the 70s, this was a huge thing, and zero population growth would be on campus signing up people. And it seems to have lost its liberal respectability, and it never had any among the right.
Well, I think,
especially the religious right.
Certainly, Jeffrey Sachs, the economist at Columbia, has written about the importance of population control. I think one thing that liberal intellectuals like Sachs want to avoid is any suggestion that you need mandatory birth control of the kind that China has instituted. So
that's interesting, because that's how it was often, against the enemies of any kind of population control, they tried to turn it into this elitist thing where the rich in the first world were trying to do sort of genocide in advance by preventing births of third world people. That was a big left wing theme,
right,
throughout the 60s and 70s. And then it just kind of weirdly, coalesces with the Catholic Churches, which is coming from completely different philosophical principles, but really toward the same ends. And, you kind of get this convergence of left and right, and then this kind of, makes it a non-topic for decades.
What makes me hopeful, I guess, is that in pretty much every society, in the process of ordinary development, along with political evolution, especially that provides women with greater civil rights, when girls start going to school, when females become educated, when they get greater opportunities for having jobs, they gain more power in politics and so forth, and they have reproductive freedom, the birth rate just goes down naturally.
And so
you don't need these mandatory.
That was one of the assumptions built into stratagem. You put more money into education and your birth rate will go down.
Okay, there you go. That seems to be a very robust finding. The problem is that in some societies you get a lag between growth in female rights and also medical improvements that lead to a reduction in child mortality,
right,
and you get at least temporarily you get a big spike in population.
And realistically, how long is it going to take, to pick a very densely populated country like China or the rural parts of India to raise education and standard of living high enough that you're going to start getting a positive feedback by, having fewer births every year?
Well, that's a good question.
Having more voluntary, if it's going to take centuries, it's not going to do you much good. And then you get the case of China where they say, I don't know what they said, but you can imagine them sitting around and saying, yeah, great, in theory, but this isn't going to happen. So
Right. One
couple, one child policy. And what was really interesting about this conference, I mentioned we had people from born all over the world. Most of them were now studying or working in the United States, but there was a young woman and a young man from different parts of China, mm-hmm. you know, Chinese born, and they were both, you know, only children uh-huh. in their family, and just talking to them was fascinating. This young woman who's at Corvallis, you know, studying in Corvallis, Oregon. She was, you know, a product of one child, you know, one couple, and her parents had grown up during the Cultural Revolution mm-hmm. and had these very visceral memories of it.
Yeah. I just have to tell the Blogging Heads audience of that I have this vivid memory of walking through the streets of Santa Fe our first or second night that we were there. And Valerie and I were looking at, for a restaurant, and actually Valerie first recognized you because she's never met you before, but she recognized you from Blogging Heads TV, and you were squiring these three very attractive young women. I guess you were looking for a restaurant, and they were from all over the world, I think. I think.
Yeah. Well, let me say, you know, just not to give a bad, bad impression. There was this woman from Chile, and I was sitting next to her in the conference, and we started talking, and she was fascinating. She had a degree in anthropology, but her father was a mining executive in northern Chile for the state-run copper company. Mm-hmm. And she had become involved, you know, both through her family connection and through her degree in anthropology, with the study of working with some of the indigenous people in the Atacama Desert region and looking into how they're impacted by copper mining.
Wow.
You know, that her father's doing. So an interesting little tension there.
And
also really getting into, like, the copper companies and how they're, you know, they sort of, apparently it's like in the United States where these businesses co-opt the term sustainability and green and use it as a marketing device. Uh-huh. So she's talking about, you know, the oxymoronic notion of sustainable mining, and you know, it was very interesting. But anyway, so just to give you some background, I was talking to her, and she was lamenting how they were kind of stuck up at St. John's College, which is a couple miles from the plaza, not getting to see Santa Fe. So I said, well, why don't we have dinner? And before long, this young woman from China I mentioned earlier joined us, and then a woman from Colombia who's been doing just this amazing work in some of the upper reaches of the rivers in the Andes Mountains among the farmers up there, and trying to investigate more sustainable farming practices. Mm-hmm. It's apparently very, very. So anyway, this was all a very intellectual endeavor that found me walking around the streets of Santa Fe with these three just amazingly smart, idealistic people that I had dinner with.
Well, great. They couldn't have had a better tour guide than you, George. And I must say,
we ended up eating at an Italian restaurant, interestingly.
Well, hearing you describe this conference and these young people who were there, it makes me hopeful. I mean, you know, I guess I think I'm in a joint farmers group, right? I think that, I think it's insane to say that there needn't be any limits to population. Obviously, that's absurd. But I'm hopeful that these young people have the intellectual and moral capacity to help us to help clean up some of the messes that their elders have created.
No, that's what struck me, and I'm sure it strikes you all the time among some of your students at Stevens mm-hmm. Any one of these people, these were all smart enough that, you know, they could have decided to go to Wall Street or get into investment banking or do something that was purely, you know, where the goal was purely to see how much money you can make and how much stuff you can get before you die.
Right.
And instead, you know, they were just, you know, committed, to using science and technology, mm-hmm. you know, to try to at least alleviate some of these problems. And they were also very practical. You know, you didn't get this, you know, pie in the sky, you know, kind of idealism that was so big a part of the 60s or 70s, or, you know, the big revolution, you know, it's going to bring us solar energy and organic foods. You know, it was just so much more sophisticated and pragmatic and yet idealistic.
Yeah, power to them. Did you get any sense of how they reacted to the kind of resuscitation of Club of Rome pessimism? coming from this guy Meadows.
Yeah, it was interesting. Yeah, because Meadows was, yeah, as I said, very pessimistic. And I think most of them were, you know, more, I mean, Meadows was a very good speaker, so he made very good points. It was all very sobering. But, you know, I think the optimism side of the debate, you know, definitely won out.
Yeah. Well, good.
Oh, I should mention another amazing thing, and this will be a nice lead into the weirdness of New Mexico. Mm-hmm. One day, we had a lecture, and this was up at the Santa Fe Institute itself, which is on the other side of town. But it was a lecture by three of the original people who started the Biosphere 2 project in Arizona.
Oh, right.
You remember that?
Yeah, sure I do.
You know, where they built that big dome, and the idea was to have a completely contained ecosystem, and then these bioneers or bionauts, I guess they were, you know, moved in there, and they had to grow their own, you know, food under this dome and you know, and live there for an extended period of time.
Yeah, it was supposed to be, almost a test bed for possibly a colony on Mars or something like that.
A colony, yeah, to colonize other planets, and it was bankrolled by this guy, Edward Bass, who was like, you know, a black sheep of the Texas oil family. Mm-hmm. This was just fascinating, and these guys are now, at least, there are three of them that were talking, and I'd say at least two of them were in their 70s. And it turns out that they all live together at this ranch south of Santa Fe called Synergia Ranch. Mm-hmm. And it turns out even, and then we all went out to Synergia Ranch and had dinner out there, and it's a very impressive place. But the thing that really impressed me was that it had been there since 1970. Mm-hmm. And this was actually one of the original New Mexico communes.
Uh-huh.
You know, back in the day when there was like New Buffalo and these other places up along Taos, you know, you see some of them in the movie Easy Rider. And this was a group of hippies that started this commune, Synergia Ranch, in the 1970. But they were like pro-technology hippies. Mm-hmm. You know, like more of the Stuart Brand kind of shtick.
Right.
You know, using technology for the good of the people. And they're still doing it.
Far out.
40 years later, they're still living in this ranch. And, you know, not all of them, but, you know, a core group of them. And they were in the biosphere. And now they're very bitter about the fact that the biosphere, you know, later their funding was pulled. And it was taken over first by Columbia University and now by the University of Arizona. Mm-hmm. So they feel like it's all been kind of ruined. And then, of course, The alternate story there is that the experiment was a failure and that needed to be rescued because you have this nice facility that was basically going to seed.
Yeah, I what I recall, I think you mentioned that when we were out in Santa Fe, and I recalled reading an article, I think it was in the Village Voice, must have been, God, I don't know, 25 years ago, a big expose of Biosphere, and it said that it had attracted some kind of weird cult-like members.
Yeah.
And there was some guy who had a criminal record, and so it was getting really flaky. And so I guess Columbia was brought in to kind of rescue it from disrepute. But
and from their point of view, Columbia came in and screwed up everything.
Right, of course.
So. Yeah, but, you know, I don't know which, you know, I'm very curious now to look into this more because, you know, I've heard two sides of the story now, but I haven't looked into either enough to form my own judgment, but.
Sounds like a great passion.
This is amazing.
Whatever happened to the biosphere?
Yeah, yeah. These are amazing people. They still are doing all these really, really amazing, strange things. Like they have a sailboat that's been in constant sail around the world, you know, again and again and again for I don't know how many years. So they contact that with radio from Rancho Synergia, and it's a really amazing facility that reflects, you know, quite a bit of investment. Mm-hmm. And they have these kind of side businesses, you know, where one of them is a company called, I think, Ecotechnics that, you know, does like, recycled, wastewater, agricultural, and drinking water systems.
Mm-hmm.
And,
wow.
But it was a trip going out there and sitting around. We were at some point at this one table, you know, eating eating dinner and talking to this guy. He was in his 70s, and he was telling, you know, stories about the old days and the biosphere. And, man, it was just really, really a trip.
Yeah.
Really brought back all of my old 1970s kind of feelings, which is both good and bad.
Just another example of the wonders of New Mexico.
Yeah. Tell us for the greater good what you saw out there, because you saw some things I didn't know about.
Well, there's kind
that
of
Valerie
there's
discovered.
Some sort of wacky stuff, and then there's more serious stuff. I guess I'll start off since we've just been talking about serious things like sustainability and sort of the biosphere. I'll start off with one thing I know that you didn't know about, and that is the it's called The Shadow of the Cross, and it's a painting of Christ that hangs in that beautiful chapel just south of Taos. It's called the Chapel of San Francisco de Assis. Georgia O'Keeffe has painted this chapel a lot. And it's not, this painting isn't hanging in the chapel itself. It's in this little building next door to it. It's a painting that that was made in 1896 by a French-Canadian artist named Henry Ault. And at some point it was discovered, and Ault always claimed that he didn't do this intentionally, that if you, the painting shows Christ standing in front of some kind of ocean landscape. But when you turn the lights off, the painting glows. The background appears luminous, almost phosphorescent, and Christ's figure becomes very shadowy, and this big cross appears sticking out above his shoulder that you can't see in the ordinary painting. Uh-huh. So, you know, you pay a couple...
Certainly something you...
you pay a couple of bucks to go see this, and you actually have to watch this this little movie in the dark, and the movie is about the chapel, but really that's just to get your eyes used to the dark.
Oh, it light adjusts, dark adjusts,
And supposedly scientists from Los Alamos have examined the painting, and they can't find any phosphorescent chemicals in it or any traces of radium or other radioactive substances. By the way, this painting was viewed as marvelous right after it was painted by this guy Ault, and it actually toured Europe and the United States, and then some rich Texas lady who had a home in Taos gave it to the chapel in the 1940s.
Really?
And the church somehow considers it not a miracle, but a mystery.
Ah, a mystery. So that's a little lesser. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, you know, of course the skeptic in me would like to see the documentation that this was actually examined by scientists, and they concluded, like, wow, there's no scientific explanation for this. When you can think of all kinds of ways that could be,
well, the thing is,
plausibly done. But
if it's a miracle, it's a pretty kind of weird humdrum one. I mean, if you're gonna have a miracle, why not cure people of cancer or something? I mean, why just have this kind of cheesy looking painting that glows in the dark?
Well, yeah, there's another. I remember, a long time ago, this was one of the first things I wrote about the weirdness of New Mexico. So it probably was back into the mid to the late 70s. But there was a story about an image of Christ, walking to Calvary with a cross on his shoulder that appeared within this pattern of stucco on this church in Holman, New Mexico, at night when the sodium vapor security light came on. So I went up there with my girlfriend and you know, we watched this happen, and all these people were just coming from all over to see the miracle, and I was kind of staring at this wall, and people were in awe, and I'm going, you know what, I don't see anything. And then suddenly it jumped out at me, and it was this very striking experience, but you know, something I could easily explain to myself as just a coincidence of shadow and light on the stucco.
It's like Camel Rock. I mean, you know, that's what humans are, pattern recognizers.
It's a bit one of my big themes in Fire in the Mind and other things, how our brains are wired to find patterns in the world around us, and if they're not there, we impose them.
That's,
So I wrote about this, and it ended up the Catholic Church sent out, you know, one of their teams of miracle investigators, or, you know, however they do that, to examine the apparition, and then they concluded that while it wasn't a bona fide miracle, it was, I don't think they even called it a mystery, but they said the miracle is in the people's devotion coming together to, you know, look at what they perceive as an image of the Christ. Jesus. And I thought, well, that was very diplomatic.
Yeah, I'll say.
Yeah.
Sometimes I feel sorry for those Catholic officials.
Well, yeah, you know, it's,
you know,
it'd be interesting to meet one of them, you know, and then.
Yeah.
I guess there's an office at the Vatican or something. But anyway, so yeah, I was really impressed when you told me about this because, you know, I sort of collect these kinds of things, and it definitely would have been in my book if I'd known about it. But it completely eluded me.
It's pretty cool.
All these years.
Well, there's another thing that I saw. It was one of my favorite visits in New Mexico, and that I know you know about. It's actually quite famous. It's the El Sanctuario de Chimayo, which is a little chapel that is sometimes called
That's
the Lourdes
wonderful.
Of America. And it's this wonderful kind of rickety, homemade feeling chapel with...
old adobe.
Yeah, adobe, and it's got this kind of folk art decoration on the inside, including one of the most gruesome statues of Christ that I've ever seen. I mean...
Oh, the religious art, yeah. You know, there's that big altar screen and what they call reredos in Spanish and, you know, tablos and just this very, 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 what would the word be? Explicit, you know, religious art. Yeah. You know, with Christ bleeding from the crown of thorns. And
well, what this is,
it's really, it's a really moving place.
It is a moving place.
If you're not religious. Yeah.
You know, I went to
You go into that room, but you saw the room, the alcove where they have the pit where people can get this dirt that's been blessed by the priest, and they, you know, like rub it on broken limbs and things, and they have these testimonials and crutches hanging on the wall.
Right, the holy dirt. So the backstory of this is that supposedly before the chapel was built, actually, this priest was in that region, and that on the night of Good Friday around 1810, he noticed this glowing spot in the hills, and he went over there
right.
and started digging through the dirt, and he found a cross buried in this spot. And so that's the spot where they have this hole in the ground in a little room off the main chapel. And people, it's weird because I was expecting it to look a little fancier. You just go in and there's just a hole in the ground with dirt in it and a little child's shovel for you to scoop up the dirt with.
Right.
And you're supposed to rub it on whatever part of you ails you. And they, you know, of course, they sell containers at the gift shop to put the dirt in. And I actually have a bum elbow. So my right elbow has been... had the shit beaten out of it by decades of playing hockey, and I also play tennis with my right arm. So I actually, you know, I picked up some dirt. By the way, this place is visited by so many people, hundreds of thousands of people a year, according to the website. As many as 30,000 people every year on Good Friday come.
Right.
I mean, really,
that's really a trip to see that. I mean, they actually walk. You know, they do a pilgrimage, many of them coming from Santa Fe, and some coming from even further south. So if you're driving up the highway north of Santa Fe toward the turnoff to Chimayo, you see people, you know, on Good Friday and for a couple days before, depending on how early a start they get, you know, just walking up the road. And occasionally you'll see someone, you know, carrying a big, heavy wooden cross.
It's remarkable. I must say, George, when I went there, I kind of had a smirk on my face, but then you know, the places, certain aspects of it, like the gift shop, are a little bit cheesy, but there's this kind of somberness to it as well.
And poignance,
especially when you see, you know, there are a lot of people who clearly were suffering. There was this one couple went in right before me and Valerie, an elderly man holding up his wife, who seemed to look like she had emphysema, she had a walker. And she was clearly in great pain, and they were going to, you know, in desperation to try to see if the holy dirt would work.
Well, it's very moving because, I mean, of course, as a non-religious person, I have, you know, I doubt the, you know, the, anything but a placebo effect. And yet, you know, there's something very moving about seeing these examples of faith. And it's just one of these very special things about New Mexico. But, you know, and I think as long as these same people aren't, you know, forgoing standard medical treatment, and I really doubt that they are, that, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe it helps psychologically.
Well, as I said, it didn't help me. On the other hand,
you didn't think for a minute that it would.
They've got a little set of directions.
You didn't get the placebo
for what you're supposed to do, and I'm holding them up now. And you know, most of the directions are things that I could go along with. It says bring silence to your heart and mind. That's all too easy in my case. Humbly acknowledge your weaknesses and mistakes and sins. I try to do that at least once every few years. Share with God your wishes and so forth. But the last one hung me up, and that's rub the holy dirt over the part of your body in need of healing while you invoke the name of Jesus as your Lord and Savior.
Yeah.
I actually did
it. So that gets a little specific for an agnostic.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, no, but I was, because I believe in the placebo effect, so I thought, you know, I really tried to be sincere, but you know, I'm sure God looked into my heart and could see that it wasn't
really
working.
Yeah, I could see. Yeah, there wasn't any upside to carrying your elbow. Did you do that high road to Taos, where you also go through this, like the villages of Atruchas and Peñasco and?
Yeah, it's beautiful. I love that.
Yeah, it's just like Tuscan hill towns in some ways, although not with the prosperity. But yeah, Truchas is, I have a part in my book where I went to some of the penitente ceremonies in a morada, which is this little, you know, chapel that the penitentes, you know, these self-penitents have in Truchas in a lot of these little villages. And yeah, I think I have the chapter in my book about all of this online from some previous need. So if I do, I'll post a link to it.
Oh, definitely.
Another one of these just really special things that you just don't quite know what to make of, being a skeptical person and yet seeing, you know, how deeply real this is to the people involved.
You know, I just wanted quickly to mention another thing I think you weren't aware of, but it's actually Mexican and not local to
New York. Yeah, you saw this amazing dance.
Yeah, so this was, there was a festival for Mexico held one day in the south of Santa Fe, and there are these
people. Oh, at Rancho de las Golondrinas.
Yeah.
Right.
I love the way you pronounce those Spanish names, George. Jesus.
Well, they're not quite. It's, I'm sure anyone who really knows Spanish will criticize my pronunciation, but I do try.
Well, I am impressed. it's called the Danza de los Voladores, the Dance of the Flyers, and it's this it's this dance ceremony that apparently arose in central Mexico maybe 500 years ago. At least that's how far back the history goes. Apparently there was a drought in this area around Veracruz, and these men supposedly cut down a tree and climbed the tree and raised it up and then climbed the tree to try to commune with the gods and ask them for rain. And then they descended and it rained and good things happened. So this led to this ceremony in which it's now mostly metal poles instead of trees, but the poles can be about 100 and up to 150 feet high. The ceremony that we saw had a pole 60 feet high, and that looked extremely high, so I can't imagine 150 feet. Five men climb this pole, and one guy stands in the center on this little tiny platform playing a little pipe and hitting a drum, and he has this elaborate dance, and he faces in the four different directions. And when he's done, the other four men descend. They're tied by their feet to ropes that have been wrapped around this pole, and they fly down back to earth in these big spinning loops around the pole, And it's really dramatic. They're wearing these outlandish costumes. They've got these headdresses that almost look like the crests of a bird. And apparently in the very early ceremonies, the men were supposed to represent birds. And it was beautiful. I've never seen anything like it.
God, that's amazing. Did you say it's from central Mexico?
Yeah, and apparently it spread throughout Mexico and all the way down to Nicaragua. There are a lot of different versions of this dance.
Yeah.
The best known dancers are in a town called Papantla, Veracruz. So these guys were from that particular town.
Yeah, way down. Yeah. God, that's fascinating. I have never seen that or run into it.
The Spanish, of course, tried to wipe this out when they encountered it. But it persisted, and it's coming back recently. There's a big controversy over the last couple of decades because one of the elders of this dance, a guy named Jesus Arroyo Cerrone, decided to train his daughters to become dancers, and this was prohibited. You know, it was very in a kind of Catholic way. They said that no, this is just for men. And then he was killed in an accident in 2006, and some of the other elders of the Bolorados said that the gods were punishing him for allowing women to become dancers.
Oh, wow.
So.
Yeah.
That's another.
God.
That's another wonder we saw in New Mexico.
Yeah. Do you have a link to the information on that
there's
you post?
There's a great.
Because I'd like to read that because this is new, another new one to me. So.
There's a great Wikipedia website on that.
Well, you know, we have our own ritual here in Santa Fe that you'll have to come out sometime. It's usually, I think, the week after Labor Day weekend, and it's called the Burning of Zozobra.
Uh-huh.
And they build this big, huge puppet, you know, like several building stories high, and then they have the fire dancer, you know, dances around it and teasingly puts the fire closer and closer to Zozobra, and who's called Old Man Gloom. Mm-hmm. So this is supposed to be burning away the sorrows for the years. And then finally the fire dancer torches Zozobra and it goes up in flames and you can, you know, see it for miles and it's really, and then they set off fireworks and things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people, I think, especially from outside of Santa Fe, think it's like an old Aztec ritual or something like this that's been imported to Santa Fe, but it's actually was started by the Kiwanis Club early in the 20th century, and this artist named Will Schuster who designed the original Zozobra. But you know, it's the big event of the year.
Uh-huh. It sounds kind of like Burning Man, or you know, one of those kind of
But it's
rituals.
It's except without the countercultural element.
Yeah.
It's much more traditional, and again, it's this need we seem to have for rituals.
Well, another thing I wanted to ask you about, because I know you know quite a bit about it, is the Pueblo, the cliff-dwelling communities. Valerie and I went to a couple of those. We got a wonderful tour guide when we went to the Puye cliff dwellings.
Oh, yeah, on the Santa Clara.
Yeah.
The Santa Clara Indian Reservation.
So that,
yeah, that's pretty interesting.
So I guess it's typical of a lot of these communities. In this case, it's a big mesa. It's one of these hills where it looks like a hill where the top has been sliced off, and it's a pretty sheer cliff all the way around. And so there was a settlement on top of the mesa, and then along the side, there were all these caves that are dug into this soft volcanic rock. And,
right,
and all these
holes
where I guess they had embedded timber. And so what you're not seeing in general in these modern relics is the structures that were built along the cliffs in the places
right.
where
they came out from the cliffs and extended the – I mean, it's similar. It's kind of a lower key version of like – Mesa Verde in Colorado, or just up the Pajarito Plateau there of Bandelier National Monument.
Yeah, well, so this guy, our tour guide, was a half Anglo, half Tiwa Indian, a guy who was, it sounded as though he had kind of drifted away from his Indian roots, but then had come back. He was teaching grade school at a local school, and he said he was training to participate in one of the Pueblo dances. I guess it's a very long training period that you go through. He hadn't done it yet. And it was funny because he was very, not sort of deliberately or maliciously at all, but he was pretty disparaging of the attempts of anthropologists to understand Pueblo culture. He said that even the Indians themselves differ on the meaning of, for example, the petroglyphs that you find in this settlement and a lot of other
right, the rock art settlements. Right.
And he said that the religious ceremonies, the meaning of certain dances, is kept very secret, even among the Indians themselves. Usually, young people don't. You can't just ask your elders about what your religious tradition is. The elders will tell you when they think you're ready for it, or when the elders feel like it. So when an outsider comes and asks one of the Indians, what's the meaning of this or that aspect of your dance, the Indians will just make stuff up.
Or just look at you silently and wait for you to change the subject. And so the anthropologists, I mean, there's been a lot written from, especially in the early parts of the 20th century, anthropologists that came mostly from the East and interviewed people about these ceremonies. But what they found out, or rather what they were told, is indeed very conflicting, and it's really still quite a mystery.
Well, what this guy said was that he knew enough to know that the meaning, first of all, the dances vary from settlement to settlement, and that the meaning of the dances also can vary widely. And of course, there were no written traditions.
Yeah.
It's only preserved orally. So he said that there was one anthropologist, a Native American named Ortiz, and I know you know about this.
Yeah,
guy,
Alfonso Ortiz.
Who had written a book that...
I knew him. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well...
Yeah, he was sort of a friend or acquaintance, I can say, anyway. But he died a decade or so ago. But yeah, he was an anthropologist who came from San Juan Pueblo, just a little north of there, and got a degree at the University of Chicago. Mm-hmm. And then he wrote this book called The Tewa Mind, explaining the Tewa worldview. And he felt that he was doing this in a responsible manner that wasn't revealing anything really secret, and that a lot of it already appeared in bits and pieces in the ethnographic literature, but he was putting it together into a coherent whole. And so this guy mentioned him and how he had been, essentially excommunicated.
Yeah, so he said that one of the exceptions to the rule of anthropologists not knowing what the hell they're talking about when they talk about Indian religions and traditions was this guy Ortiz, was Native American himself. But
right.
He said that Ortiz actually did write accurately about his own Pueblo's tradition, but there were two things. First of all, the guide said that as a result, Ortiz was ostracized by other members of his tribe. Second, that Ortiz suggested that the rituals and their interpretations, their meaning, as he described them, were true of all these other different Pueblos as well. And our guide said that just isn't the case, that there's tremendous diversity in these religious traditions, even from settlements that are very close to each other.
Yeah, that's interesting. And yet there are these structural similarities, at least if you can believe the anthropologists. Like, all these Pueblos in New Mexico and Arizona have very similar creation stories where the hero twins emerge from this this hole in the earth, which led to the spirit world where everyone came from inside the earth. And then they went north, south, east, and west, and set out the cardinal directions. And each direction is associated with a different mountain and a different color and a different animal and a different mineral. And the specifics, vary from Pueblo to Pueblo, and the languages are vastly different between many Pueblos, and yet they have the same kind of structure to them.
Yeah, the relationship of the native people in these regions and the scientists is really complicated and tense.
It is. And And the scientists really try to respect their privacy. I mean, this has changed a lot from the swashbuckling days of early New Mexico anthropology, when they would, you know, just kind of, you know, come in and try to get all the press for all the information they can get. And you know, now it's much more respectful and give and take, but at the same time, you know, not a lot of information is becoming known, and then you have to decide whether you think that's a good thing or a bad one.
Well, you know, we went to the Taos Pueblo too, which I found fascinating. So I didn't realize that here's this settlement that has been continuously occupied for almost 1,000 years now. There are about 150 people still living in these structures that are many, many centuries old. There's no running water. You know, they're trying to preserve their way of life. Some of them have second homes, but in this particular community, there is no running water or electricity. But even then, it's kind of weird because, you know, they're selling jewelry and other things to the tourists. They are very friendly, but you know, I got a brochure at the Taos Pueblo that says the Tiwa language, here's an exact quote, is unwritten, unrecorded, and will remain so. The Tiwa language being the language of these people. The details of our traditional values are guarded as sacred and are not divulged. Understand that the past oppressions upon our culture have required us to keep the details unspoken.
Right.
Then I looked at the history of the Taos Pueblo, and they have just been brutalized by white people. First, the Spaniards.
Well, the Spanish incursion with the Franciscans and the conquistadores.
You know, there were multiple rebellions beginning in the 1700s and through the middle of the
19th
century.
The Pueblo Revolt in 1680. They, you know, the Taos was very much part of that, and you know, where they basically rose up and drove the Spanish out of New Mexico for like 12 years until they came back during the Reconquest.
Yeah, and yet these are people
which is celebrated every week in Santa Fe during that's the same week, you know, Fiestas, when they have the burning of Zozobra.
Uh-huh.
So you saw this history. You know, I was just flipping through my book, Fire in the Mind. It reminded me, you know, I've already forgotten, you know, a lot of stuff that I wrote about. But so I was holding it up there. I was trying to remember the story. It was Edward Harrington was this anthropologist who came out here and went to Santa Clara, the same pueblo we were talking about, where Puyehue Cliff dwellings are, and a lot of these northern Rio Grande pueblos, to put together this this book of place names from, you know, the different from the Tewa world, and he, you know, wrote this book that was considered very authoritative, and he was really an interesting character. His wife or widow wrote a biography of him later that was really, really quite striking. I wonder if I can find the name of it. But anyway, so Harrington was riding around on horseback with these people from Santa Clara and San Juan, and they were telling him the names of these things, and he was dutifully recording them. So I was talking to Alfonso Ortiz, the San Juan Tewa Indian anthropologist we were just mentioning, you know, one day at lunch, and he was saying, "Oh yeah, Harrington, my uncles remember when Harrington came." Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, he would give him a quarter, you know, for every, you know, place name they could tell him. So they rode around with him, and, you know, he said probably when they were, you know, pretty close to the pueblo, they probably got the names right, but then they'd go further and further, and, you know, they didn't know what the hell this hill was called, or if they did, they didn't want to tell him, so they just make something up, and, you know, Harrington would give them a quarter, and it all went down into the ethnographic record.
That's great.
I don't know, I love stuff like that.
And yet, I think one of the tragic ironies is that the Indians are overwhelmingly Christian.
And that's another weird thing that I got into in Fire in the Mind, how Catholicism was sort of, you know, they didn't give up their traditional religions, they just kind of combined it with Catholicism or gave it a veneer of Catholicism to, you know, make the priests happy, and then later this kind of took. So now, like, before the feast day at San Ildefonso Pueblo, they'll have a mass at the Catholic church the night before. Mm-hmm. But then the next morning, you know, the buffalo dancers will emerge from the kiva, you know, symbolizing the emergence, you know, from the from the spirit world underground, or, you know, at least that's the outsider's interpretation. But you just watch it and you're just really struck by the mystery and the impenetrability.
Yeah. It's well, anyway, I can see why you live out there, George. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
First of all, I mean, you know, apart from all these specific places and marvels to look at, it's just so breathtakingly beautiful, the whole place. I love the desert and the mountains, and the people were great. So, you know, we're going to have...
Yeah, I was really glad you could come out here. And, you know, a lot of times you live a place long enough, of course, you start taking it for granted. So it was nice to be reminded of these things and to learn about this new one up in Rancho de Taos with the glowing painting.
Check it out.
I will.
All right, I guess we're through an hour.
Oh, sure enough. Wow, that went fast.
Yeah, so fun as always. And well, I hope to talk to you, I don't know, if not before the summer's over, then after school begins.
Sounds good. And I'll look forward sometime in the future to a tour of the Hudson Valley, your stomping grounds.
Anytime.
Okay, John.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Good talk.